This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. More than a quarter of a million people have died in Syria since 2011, making it the worst ongoing war internationally. Every few months, it seems as though the war becomes more complex, with shifting allegiances, multiple and overlapping regional and global players entering the arena. Civilians are killed on almost all sides. Now, a coalition of Syrian forces opposed to President Bashar al-Assad have presented a plan to transition out of the war. According to the BBC, quote, the High Negotiations Committee, or HNC, proposed holding 6 months of negotiations with Assad, accompanied by a full ceasefire. Mr. Assad would then hand over power to a unity government that would run Syria for 18 months and organize elections, end of quote. Apparently, Assad himself would not step down as part of the plan. It remains to be seen if this, like past plans, would actually result in anything positive. My guest is Robin Yassin Khassab. He is the author, with Leila Al-Shami, of the book Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. His earlier book, a novel, is called The Road from Damascus. He's written about Syria in The Guardian, The National, Foreign Policy, The Daily Beast, Newsweek, and Al Jazeera. And he's also a co-editor and regular contributor to Pulse. Welcome to the program, Robin.
Thank you. Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about the plan and the High Negotiations Committee. Who does this HNC actually represent? The BBC described it as a coalition of the political and armed factions opposing Assad. Is it actually representative of the sort of broad range of groups that have been fighting Assad since 2011?
It's broadly representative. I mean, it's never won an election. Of course, we've never had the opportunity to have an election in Syria to choose a government or to choose a negotiations committee to try and end the dictatorship. The only people in Syria who have actually been elected are the heads of local councils, democratic local councils in Syria. They are not represented enough in the higher national committee, in the higher negotiations committee. So it's not perfect. Having said that, it does bring together a range of community leaders, social leaders, political leaders, some from the elite opposition, some grassroots activists, and some of the armed factions. So it is a pretty broad church. It does represent something. I think a lot of Syrians, quite possibly the majority of Syrians, would like to see the HNC being taken very seriously.
And so what do you make of this plan? It's a three-part plan that basically includes 6 months of negotiations, which in the Syrian timeline, a lot of people can die in 6 months. It's not clear that anybody would necessarily set aside their weapons or have a clear ceasefire. But how do you assess this multi-part plan?
It looks like a very good plan. I mean, its aim is to end up with a democracy in Syria and for rights for every community in Syria and for every community in Syria to be protected. And obviously, I think the world should be trying to get to that aim. It's a very mature and sensible plan in that they have very specifically said we don't want to happen what happened in Iraq after the regime change. Of course, that was different. It wasn't by revolution. It was by external intervention. But what happened in Iraq was that the Sunni community was kind of blamed en masse for the crimes of Saddam Hussein. And you got the Shia community taking over instead, or people claiming to represent the Shia community, which then led to the alienation of the Sunnis, which then along the line led to the war with ISIS. What they're saying is they don't want that to happen in Syria. They don't want to get rid of everybody associated with the old regime. And I think that's very sensible. The best thing in the plan is the desire to rely on local council and local administrative bodies which have been set up by Syrians in the last years. That's very important. The problem with the plan is that it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen because Assad, Bashar al-Assad, and his imperialist backers from Iran and from Russia are not being put under any pressure. They've got no reason to cooperate with this plan, so therefore they won't. They will continue bombing in Syria, and as a result, the war will go on, the refugees will keep coming, jihadism will continue to rise, and this hell of a mess is going to continue.
So then would you say that there really cannot be any kind of serious peace in Syria without removal of Assad in some way, or him stepping down? I mean, essentially, as long as Assad remains in power, and any plan that accepts him remaining in power will not work. It's either Assad and war or possible peace without Assad. Is that the way you see it?
Well, ultimately, yes, that's the case. I mean, we don't want to be extreme about this. The most important thing now is peace. The most important thing is that the bombs stop falling and that the refugees can go home. Now, once we've got a truce, a ceasefire, then everything will change. I would expect that the appeal of jihadism, for example, will go down radically amongst the Syrian people. A lot of men will be happy to disarm themselves. The local councils and the activists will have a lot more power, and then we can really start moving forward. Now, if Bashar al-Assad shows, and his backers, more to the point, if he shows that he's seriously interested in working towards a peaceful transition, and he doesn't have the maximalist aim of bombing his way back to absolute power over every inch of Syria, then look, the guy can stay until, you know, the important thing is not what happens to one man. The important thing is peace for the Syrian people. The problem is that he has never once shown that he's willing to change his behavior. And I think the reason for that is that his behavior has been appeased and, in fact, backed up. He's got international support for his behavior. Obama back in 2013, back in 2012, Obama said that the use of chemical weapons would be a red line. And then in 2013, Assad used chemical weapons. He killed 1,500 people with sarin gas in 5 hours in the Damascus suburbs, and the red line disappeared. So, of course, today we've got more reports of chlorine gas attacks coming in. If you don't put the guy under some kind of pressure, then he has no reason to stop murdering his way back to the throne over a completely destroyed country. And of course, that creates security problems for the whole world, not just for Syria.
Right. And so then this whole mess began in 2011 after essentially Syrians who had had enough of staying silent through the Assad regime, seeing the Arab Spring revolts around them, felt inspired to do the same. And as you describe in your book, Burning Country, the Assad regime crushed the rebellion so brutally that it essentially pushed a lot of folks into either picking up arms and forming the various militias, and some even into these sort of fundamentalist groupings. And it's just been downhill ever since. Can you take us back, particularly for those of us, I think, who need a refresher course when we're looking at this brutal, brutal war, where Assad got his power from to begin with? You said that there haven't been elections in Syria. So how did he come to power in the first place?
Well, the Ba'ath Party came to power, which is a kind of Arab nationalist party. Originally, it had socialist leanings. You could, in some ways, say it was a fascist party because it was national socialist. It was more nationalist than socialist. It came to power by military coup, so it wasn't really the party. It was army officers. It came to power by military coup in 1963, and at that point they set up a dictatorship. They finished the free press. They stopped elections. They repressed dissenters, and they set up a nationalist dictatorship. By 1970, Hafez al-Assad came to power within the Ba'ath Party. There was another internal coup within the military, and Hafez al-Assad came to power, and he really made the state even more totalitarian. He gradually, as the years went on, got rid of the socialist and state-building aspects of his regime, and it just became a vehicle of power. But he died in the year 2000, and his son, Bashar al-Assad, inherited power from his father. So although he's called a president, he's more like a king because it's a hereditary, it was a hereditary transfer of power from the dictator to his son. When Bashar al-Assad first came to power, he said that he was going to engage in a reform process, and people were very hopeful at first. It looked like there were going to be some political reforms, but very quickly those were stopped and rolled back. There were economic reforms, but unfortunately these were neoliberal economic reforms and also crony capitalist economic reforms, which ended up, for example, with his cousin, Bashar al-Assad's cousin, Rami Makhlouf, ended up with a finger in 60% of the national economy. So a few people who were close to power became incredibly rich, and the vast majority of people sank into poverty. So this was the background for the revolution. But remember, in 2011, unlike in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, the protesters out on the streets at first were not asking for the downfall of the regime. It wasn't actually a revolution at first. It was a protest movement asking for reforms and asking for some degree of social justice and dignity, for an end to torture and so on. It was when the regime responded to that with such extreme and horrific violence, torturing, you know, non-violent, non-sectarian protesters to death, torturing children to death, raping people in their houses and shooting people down in the streets. It was because of that it then became a revolution, and then some months on, it began to arm and it began to turn into a war.
It's incredible to think about this entire conflict having started because of one man's desire to cling to power, and rather than actually listen to those calls for reform, take actions that ended up worsening this war and continuing to worsen this war. Tell us about, in your book, you describe an activist, Razan Zaitouneh, who you said really embodied the kind of revolutionary spirit that emerged from 2011, a human rights lawyer who worked tirelessly to try to organize ordinary Syrians. Who was she and what happened to her?
It's very important to know about Razan Zaitouneh and thousands of people like her that we don't usually hear about through the media. The story that the mainstream media or the media in general, including the alternative media, very often gives us is the same story that Assad gives us, that all of his opponents are mad jihadists, head choppers, and so on. Those people have been empowered by Assad and by the trauma of war, unfortunately. But there are thousands of people like Razan. She was a human rights lawyer. She was somebody who worked for democracy and for rights for everybody. When the revolution started, she was one of the founding members of the local coordination committees, which was a grassroots revolutionary unit. In each neighborhood, you would have a local coordination committee which would help get the protests going, which would guard against sectarianism and victimization in those revolutionary communities. As time went on, their work shifted, and they kind of fed into the developing local councils, and they started doing much more administrative work in liberated communities, aid work, setting up field hospitals, the same kind of thing. Razan was on the run for the first part of the revolution, but then she went to a liberated suburb of Damascus called Douma, and she worked out in the open until in 2013 she was abducted. She and three other people were abducted, probably by an Islamist authoritarian militia called Jaish al-Islam, and she's never been heard of since.
Others were abducted, right?
Pardon?
She and three others were abducted together.
Correct. Yeah. They're known as the Douma Four. Yeah. So the four of them were abducted, and we've never heard anything more of them. We hope not, but probably they've been killed. And this tragic story, you know, has been echoed again and again and again and again. Syrian people struggling for democracy and for rights in a creative and intelligent way are under fire from all sides, from the fascist regime itself, from its international allies, from Russia, which is bombing from the sky, from Iran, which is sending tens of thousands of occupation troops. And they're also under attack from jihadists, Sunni jihadists, who have piled into the country to try and take advantage of the situation for their own agenda, and all kinds of authoritarian forces within Syrian society who have also been liberated, if you like, by the chaos.
Now, what could have been done, or what could have happened in those early days of 2011 to try to, or were there mistakes made, I should say, that might inform a process going forward, a process at Fort by the HNC? Or is it too late for that? Is Syria so broken right now that any attempts at political organizing must really be sort of put aside and simply having an end to the atrocities be the first priority?
Well, I think the two can't be separated. I mean, you can't really get a lasting, real ceasefire without addressing the political problems. But certainly the first thing must be a ceasefire. And to do that, I think what you need in Syria is a no-bombing zone. People talk, a lot of so-called leftists in the West talk about a no-bombing zone or a no-fly zone as if it would be some terrible imperialist imposition on the Syrian people. They don't seem to understand that America and France and Britain are bombing in Syria every day. The problem is that they're bombing the symptom of the problem rather than the cause of the problem. They are not putting pressure on Iran and Russia to stop bombing and killing in Syria. Barack Obama, the crowning achievement of his presidency, supposedly, has been his deal with Iran. Now, I'm not unhappy in the abstract to see America doing a deal with Iran and bringing more peace to the world, but it's the wrong moment when Iran suddenly becomes so expansionist and sectarian and start sending tens of thousands of jihadists to Syria, Shia jihadists, which just creates much more of a Sunni jihadist backlash, which is hurting all of us. Russia and Iran should not be appeased. They should be stopped. That doesn't mean that the Americans should go in and declare war on Russia, of course not, but diplomatically and economically, there's much more they can do to stop them bombing in Syria. And they could tell Assad that, look, we're not going to come in and do a regime change. That's the business of the Syrian people. But if you use your airfields to bomb Syrian civilians and hospitals and marketplaces and to drop chlorine on them, and you're creating a terrorism problem and a refugee problem, which is destroying Europe and affecting American politics, if you do that, we will come in and we will not bomb you in your palace, but we will destroy the airfield. We will destroy the military base from which you are firing at Syrians. If that happened, if there weren't bombs dropping from the sky, then the traumatization and the extremism could begin to get under control. It is too late for the happy ending that we dreamed of in 2011, 2012. Of course, it's going to be enormously difficult, if not impossible, to build a democratic, socially just society out of the wreckage of Syria. But we have to try. We have to start doing something to try and calm this down, because this is such a huge problem. It's still escalating and it's going to burn everybody.
What happened, Robin, to the local coordination committees on the local level? Are some of those still operating, just even providing some level of social infrastructure to people, trying to at least survive day to day?
Yes, the local coordination committees in very difficult circumstances are still functioning. But much more important than them now is the local councils in Syria. Now, these local councils have been organized by local committees in liberated areas, and they're non-ideological. Their jobs are to try to get to keep life going in these areas which are being bombed. So they're trying to keep the electricity on, they're trying to keep water flowing, they're trying to set up makeshift hospitals and underground schools to try and keep people's lives going despite the bombing. In many cases, these work on a democratic basis. On about 45% of cases, these councils are actually democratically elected by the people in the area, in and that's remarkable. And we don't talk about it, which is shocking. If you think about it, one of the excuses for invading Iraq in 2003. One of the British and American excuses for that terrible crime was that they wanted to bring democracy to the Arabs. And of course that didn't work, because you can't bring democracy to people. They have to do it themselves. They have to build their own democracy. Today in Syria, in the most difficult of circumstances, under attack from almost everybody, ordinary rank and file Syrians are self-organizing and practicing democracy, and we don't even talk about it. We just talk about the jihadists and the foreign states. And that's really shocking. I think that's a failure of our media, of our culture, that we don't care about that. We don't look at it. We don't want to see it, because we're more comfortable with stories about the Middle East all being to do with jihadism and foreign interventions. We can't see the agency of the people on the ground, even during a time of revolution.
And so could these local councils, you know, if there was a time when Assad's regime was seeing its last days, could these local councils then form that backbone, as we were discussing earlier in our conversations, the backbone of a future democratic, socially just Syria? Because, of course, that is the end goal.
Yes, they could. And I think it's really important that when we do finally, however long it takes, get a ceasefire in Syria and a real political process, that we try to strengthen these grassroots, local bodies, local administrative units, which the people themselves have made. They haven't been imposed from outside. The people who have been elected to positions on these councils are the only representative Syrians that we have. They're the only people that have put themselves up for election and won election. The other thing about local democracy in Syria is that it could potentially diffuse the now extreme polarization sometimes between different Syrian communities. If you had more autonomy at a local level, that means that you could have communities which are very Sunni Muslim, quite conservative. They could decide, for example, to ban alcohol. Whereas you could have other communities which have got lots of Christians and Alawis and secularists in them, which would decide, no, in our community, we're going to have alcohol available and we'll have nightclubs. If you had more local democracy, then those two communities could coexist underneath the Syrian umbrella. It could also mean, I think that the HNC and other Syrian opposition bodies should, although I'm very worried about the Kurdish PYD and its one-party state that it's trying to build, the mainstream opposition should openly and publicly recognize the Kurdish right to autonomy within Syria. And we could allow, you know, this could be easily done if in the Arab majority areas they have local councils which run most things, and in the Kurdish majority areas they have local councils which run education in the local language, etc., etc. I think this is one of the best ways to move forward, and it's a tragedy that these people on these councils have not been more empowered.
Finally, Robin, what advice would you give to the U.S. anti-war movement, which doesn't seem to have much of a coherent strategy on Syria? And it's not an easy war to sort of figure out, you know, throwing a clear solution for to begin with. But, you know, it certainly seems as though some factions within the U.S. anti-war movement are a little bit ignorant of what's really happening on the ground, as many of us are.
Well, a lot of people on the so-called left seem to think that what's happening in Syria is another Iraq. They seem to think that this is a regime change plot directed by the United States and Israel. The facts, I'm afraid, do not bear that out at all. Quite the opposite is the case. Even if you look at the American rhetoric, what they want is for Bashar al-Assad to go, but for the regime to stay in place. That's not supporting the Syrian revolution. The most significant military intervention that the Americans have made has been to veto other countries from sending in the anti-aircraft weapons, which the Free Syrian Army so desperately needed to defend their communities from aerial assault. Not for offense, not to go and get Assad out of his palace, but to defend their communities from Assad's scorched earth. If the Free Syrian Army had been properly armed, or if other people had been allowed to properly arm the Free Syrian Army, the Americans stopped them, then you wouldn't have had the rise of the other jihadist groups who have come in and exploited the vacuum and exploited the fact that the Free Syrian Army was weak. The Americans, as I said, Obama's just done a deal with Iran at the same moment that Iran has got tens of thousands of occupation troops fighting for the dictator in Syria. Obama is discussing with Russia very hard how to coordinate bombing against Jabhat al-Nusra and other types of jihadist groups in Syria at the same moment that Russia is dropping napalm on Syrian civilians, on working class residential blocks, and on hospitals. Russia is committing war crimes, and the Americans have got nothing to say about that, and they're certainly not doing anything about it. So I think the analysis is completely wrong. The Assad regime is not an anti-imperialist resistance regime. It's a neoliberal fascist regime which worked, which tortured people for the CIA and during the war on terror. And the rest of it, the analysis is wrong. It's also a silly kind of binarism which bases itself on states. So it thinks that if we're against American imperialism, we must therefore support Russian or Iranian imperialism. And this is just ridiculous because all imperialisms are filthy. All states are filthy. You know, states represent the elites in control of them. That's real left-wing thinking. What we should be doing is supporting the people inside states who are struggling against people who are trying to keep them down. Now, if the left had done that, it would have maybe had the right to give advice to Syrian revolutionaries, but it doesn't even know that there's a revolution going on. Most leftists, there are some great exceptions to the rule.
Well, Robin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Our correspondent, Rahul Mahajan, recommended your book as the best one out there on Syria. And so we're really glad to have you on. Good luck to you and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thanks very much.
Robin Yassin Kassab is the author with Leila Al-Shami of Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. He's written about Syria in The Guardian, The National Foreign Policy, The Daily Beast, and more. He's also a co-editor and regular contributor to Pulse. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com and on Facebook at facebook.com/ruwithsonali.